You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, this is Michael Silverblatt. Welcome to Bookworm. My guest today is Stephen Dobbins, author of Aftershocks, Near Escapes, recently published by Viking Penguin. He's a three-hatted individual. He's published at least 7 books of poetry, most recently Body Traffic. He writes novels, and he's the author as well of the Saratoga series of thrillers, most recently Saratoga Hexameter. In any case, there's a sort of ongoing grisliness in your preoccupations, and I wondered where it came from.
Well, I think as a writer or as a human being, there's that constant question of how do you live, where are you going, and that forces one to focus on one's own mortality, you know. And that's the issue of my mortality or human mortality is something that is constantly addressed in all of my work, just that mystery. And I think as a writer as well, that you're partly engaged in jarring the reader's own complacency to the extent of that you want them to think about, the reader to think about the world. I mean, mostly at any moment of time, we're only thinking of that moment of time. We don't have a sense of the arc of our lives, the past and the present and future of our lives. And any good poem, any novel, works to remind the reader or lead the reader to think about the arc of their lives. And that inevitably leads to mortal thoughts.
There's a certain tone that as a reader I came first to find in Nathaniel West and then eventually as a reader of poetry in Weldon Keyes, a kind of creepiness that's slightly comic, but nevertheless an interest in, at least in prose, haunted house effects. Do you like those writers?
Keyes I liked a great deal. And he was certainly a mysterious writer, partly in that his car was found at the foot of the Golden Gate Bridge and he was never seen again. There is a kind of comic element to him. It's that sort of comic element that sees death as the final pratfall. And then in other ways, he's a very morbid writer. I liked him because I felt that he was, in his best poems, was a wonderful stylist and you know, had wonderful lines. You know, the poems made me really sit up straight. One of the contemporary poets who I admire the most and who had taught where I went to school, Donald Justice, had edited Keyes. And so from reading Justice, I sort of automatically went on to read Keyes.
It's a sort of odd thing because Auden described it as West's disease, that tendency or tropism toward the somewhat darkly comic, melancholic end-of-the-world air. And I wondered, you know, sometimes in a certain kind of writing, I guess the first book I read of yours was the Balthus poems, and I thought, oh, well, you know, any guy who's heading Balthus words is interested to some level in the perverse to begin with. Is there, you know, the danger of collecting morbid arcana?
I don't see it as more. I mean, I suppose this is my normal kind of thought, so I don't catch my thought and say that I'm being morbid. A poet that I like a great deal is Philip Larkin. Mm-hmm. And Larkin had tremendous occupation with death. And what you see in him, I think, is a terror of being taken by surprise, that he wanted to think out the whole, all the ramifications of that subject, not to avoid it, but so it wouldn't take him unawares, as, of course, death must always take you by unawares. I don't know where my own interest in it comes. Death is dramatic, obviously. Death is the end of any story. Death is one of the few closures we have in life, and death and the orgasm, you know, and that pretty much defines our range. It's fascinating. It's where we're going. It's what we don't think about. You know, everybody else will die except you.
In your new book, Aftershocks, Near Escapes, which is a book set in Chile in 1960. And, well, it begins in 1960 and opens during the earthquake. The book provides the occasion. Death doesn't really end the story. It opens the story. And it provides the occasion, really, for what, for its first 40 or 50 pages, amounted for me to a long poem about disaster, closer in a way to your poetry, and in a way a bit to Philip Levine's around the Not This Pig period than I thought of other novels being. Was it a departure for you, prose-wise?
I think I carefully wanted to make it different from the novel, the serious novel which had preceded it, which was The Two Deaths of Signora Puccini. There's a subject that I keep returning to, both in poetry and in fiction, which is that moment as a human being that you discover, in a way, what life is all about. That everything around you that you assume is permanent is not permanent, is transient. And so the 8-year-old girl in this novel suddenly has to deal with this world that had seemed completely permanent being turned upside down. On the other hand, the novel also deals with, I mean, it's a novel that's being related, as it were, by a woman in her late 30s who suddenly has a whole different sense of time and what memory is and how your memories are different depending where you are in your life. And so in a sense, both of these women, the same woman, the 8-year-old and the 38-year-old, have had these overwhelming experiences, and the two are kind of folded together in that way. But I'm aware of that in many poems. That, I mean, writing is always that act of discovery, that you start something thinking you're writing about A, and it turns out you're writing about B. And looking back, I can see many things that have as their subject that moment of change, that you go into a situation thinking life is this way, and it suddenly you see it's that way. It's not necessarily better or worse, but different than what you had thought.
I guess for me, that sentence-by-sentence accumulation of aftershocks, of moments of trees dislodging their child inhabitants, of train tracks rising like snakes, of the earth imagined swallowing cities, seemed either, you know, like a montage or in film, or some of the effects in poetry where image,
right.
Sort of litigating against narrative or substituting for narrative. It seemed to me to be more a poem effect or prose poem effect, as in Malcolm Lowry. So it seemed to me to be a book that was giving a poet the chance to go on a spree.
I think that's true. It's that accumulation of images. For me also, it was what I enjoyed in the writing of it was the creation of a certain tone and a voice that is, you know, how far away could you get from my normal voice, an 8-year-old Chilean girl? But to make a voice that was then a compelling, convincing voice. And that was an ambition that caught my attention. I mean, in any writing, at some point, there's that pleasure of selling the reader the Brooklyn Bridge. You know, whatever other passions you have, you know, you want to make something compelling. And a novel is both about its subject and it's about the writer's imagination.
I'm led just by, I guess, pure pleasure to say that Stephen Dobbins is the author as well of Cold Dog Soup, which is a title which, when named, provokes the same kind of nervous titters as the title of Paul Bowles' anthology, She Woke Me Up, So I Killed Her.
Yeah, well, it's a similar genre, perhaps. Cold Dog Soup was probably the first of the serious novels that I've been working on. At the time, I was going back and forth between New York City and Santiago, Chile, fairly often. And I was staying with friends in New York who were fairly wealthy, and I'd go down to Santiago, which was tremendously poor. And in many ways, the novel is about third world, first world irrationality. I mean, very simply, it's about two men try to sell a dead dog in New York City. But one of the men is a Haitian cab driver, and the other is a computer technician. And I like the outrageousness of it. I mean, in any novel or anything I write, I love to just, how can you take something just to the very edge of probability? How can you make it seemingly improbable but real? In the aftershock, certainly. I mean, the descriptions of the earthquake and that whole surreal, peculiar event. I had talked to many, many people in southern Chile and had stories from them, and their stories were odd. I mean, one man talked about a wave that came into his, that overswept the house next door. I mean, he was living a mile from the sea. A wave overswept the house next door, took the house away, and then when he looked out his window, his whole yard was full of candles, and nothing else was there. You know, he'd been a mile from the sea with all these other houses in the way, and now he was on the beach with a yard full of candles.
That's in the book, too, yeah.
But there are many of that, many stories like that, which you would think are like magic realism, but mm-hmm. they're true stories.
It is interesting because while reading the book, I loved it and loved its narrator, Lucy, especially her childlike memories or the sound sometimes of the child who narrates Days of Heaven when she says, for instance, of a dog, he was a friend of mine. He bit other people, but he was a special friend of mine. But I guess knowing your work at the same time, I felt while I was reading the sometimes tender and sometimes brutalized memories of a woman who's now been through the mill a bit, I felt a countercurrent of reading an author who's a somewhat chilly connoisseur of chaos and felt the weird wobble you feel when on the one hand a painful and emotional situation is being responded to in its normal way with shock and some degree of dread and horror, especially since this particular reader was reading the book during the earthquake season here in Los Angeles, and then at the same time feeling that there's a collector's impulse to gather philatelist-like, brilliant and horrific instances of a cutting terror.
Mm-hmm. If I'm working on a story or a book or a poem, what I move into is a complete belief in what I'm doing. That the details that from which the book or the poem is assembled are manufactured or imagined or overheard. But at some point, I become my best reader. That I believe this. You know, this is my own inspiration or intuition or whatever. Obviously, when I finish that process, I go back and revise the book and become, that's that schizophrenic element of writing, that you begin in dream and you end in technology. That's a wonderful thing about writing. I mean, that's one of the things that's very exciting about it for me. But that part that writes it in dream is completely convinced of the dream. If finally the pieces of that technology or dream show through, then that becomes a weakness that I've somehow deceived myself about its surface. I mean, as a writer, one's always dealing with one's own propensity for self-deception, and one's constantly challenging that in oneself.
I've been talking to Stephen Dobbins, the author of Aftershocks, Near Escapes, an extraordinary novel about the Chilean earthquake in 1960, as narrated by an older woman thinking about her 8-year-old self the day the earth shook. Thank you very much for being with us. My second guest today is Mark Jacobson, the author of Gojiro, published by Atlantic Monthly Press. Who's the narrator of this novel, Mark?
The narrator of this novel is the monster, more or less. He's told in what I guess they call the deflected third person or first person. In other words, he's clearly the narrator of the book, even though it's told in the third person. I developed this narration technique after writing a 900-page draft, which was told in the first person, which I found to be a little impenetrable.
So it's narrated by a Japanese horror movie monster who actually, because of nuclear fission, etc., is in part inhabited by everyone else in the book.
Mm-hmm. Well, the conceit in the end of the book is that he embodies the entire world, but we don't have to skip ahead that far.
It is what influences the prose style. What's neat about this prose style is that, you know, this is more a mutant than a monster. And so there are all sorts of different elements of prose bopping up inside it.
Well, he's sort of a repository of all popular culture and what's called the flot jet of modern society since 1945. He has these kind of... this is kind of an unwanted presence in his mind, although it dominates him. So therefore, in as much as the culture impacts upon everybody, yeah, he does embody everybody in the book, and everybody who's not in the book.
And he has a quadricameral mind, so that the breakdown of the bicameral mind has been squared in this particular case.
Well, yeah, you know, you can steal from all kinds of different sources. So Julian Jaynes, you know, he wrote a book called...
Breakdown of the bicameral mind.
Yes, breakdown of the rise of consciousness and the breakdown of the bicameral mind.
Which is no wonder, typical of me, that I'd only remember the breakdown part.
Well, yeah, don't want to emphasize the negative too much here. But, no, actually, that book was a brilliant book, although he can't write so well, so you can't really understand what he's saying. But I actually used that idea of the bicameral mind with a now basically discredited theory of the brain, which is called the triune brain, in which you believe this fellow named Paul McLean, who's the head of the National Institute of Mental Health for a while, believed that you have three existing working brains in your mind. The top part, which is your neocortex, which is we are, and then below that is sort of as a sedimentary rock, you'd have the limbic system, which was developed in the age of mammals, you know, like lemurs and little kind of guys with twitchy noses and stuff like that. And then at the bottom would be your R complex, the stuff that's left over from reptiles. And, you know, in this kind of Ptolemaic sense of humanity, people believe that this part of your brain was extinct, you know, just no longer functional, like a vestigial thing. But Mr. McLean believes, and it seems a kind of compelling argument, that actually it's in there, you know, and some people's R complex, which controls your territoriality and your aggressive behavior and, you know, desire to get ahead, you know, is more developed than other people and it's more repressed than others. You know.
Well, the bookworm likes books that are a medley of styles, especially medleys of styles that are, you know, fused with conceptual content. But as they used to say in the writing programs, this has more voices than the Mormon Tabernacle Choir.
Is that what they say?
And that's what they said sometimes, you know.
Well, it's a little hipper than that.
We were talking earlier before the show started about some of the influences, people you like. You started with Lord Buckley, but who else is on the list?
Well, I'm influenced by certain lousy journalists like R. Meltzer and... not lousy, just sort of offbeat. I also am influenced a lot by people like non-writers like Thelonious Monk and the way Earl Monroe used to play basketball, things like that. I don't mean to be to be evasive about this, but the fact of the matter is I'm just not that well read. But I was a journalist for about 25 years before I started doing this, and I was constantly sent into as a shock troop. I mean, among the other stories with the dead guys with the chalk marks around, in which there were many, I was kind of in this first line of like pop culture reporting. So I think that once you start doing this, it really eats away at your brain and kind of shapes you in the sense that it becomes an obsession. So and unfortunately for my financial situation, since I write books for a living, you just don't have much time to sit down and actually read a book when you're like obsessed with the popular culture.
Has this book entered popular culture? There's been a forced attempt to send it barreling into the fortress.
I'm very pleased, actually, in a way. This is the first kind of lit thing I've ever done. And it's just like, almost all the radio stuff I've done has been on rock and roll stations, all unsolicited. Like, people that are deeply into Joey Ramone called me up and said, I love your book, and you need to come on my show, you know? And the more NPR type people sort of feel that this is, what is it? But the little girls, they understand, if you know what I mean.
Oh, come on, this is a literary novel.
No, it's completely, I don't mean it. I mean it as a literary novel. And in fact, I would be very heartbroken if people didn't take it that way.
No. It reminds me of those novels that fictionalize their contents extremely, like John Barth Segal's Goat Boy, and then address the whole world. And so this is a book about evolution and nuclear culture, and it's mythic. The monster has to find, ultimately, his father and mother, and inevitably, you know, all of our fathers perhaps are the bomb, and, you know, eventually killing the father, too, is a job eatable of this monster, Gojiro, in the novel by Mark Jacobson, published by Atlantic Monthly Press.
Yes.
Ha!
Yes. How neatly you did that. Paul, you'll have to correct me on the French pronunciation, although I read all his books and I can't pronounce his name yet. Paul Valéry, he says that cosmology is literary art. And I believe that in this book, the main goal that I set for myself was to create this because he's a Japanese movie monster is not really exactly accurate.
He's a monster who's brought to the movies.
Yes, he's not unlike a Japanese movie monster in the sense that people can relate to him that way. But he started as a regular lizard in a small island, and he was hit on the head with the atom bomb, and through the amazing elasticity of radioactive fallout, which is the great finger paint of modern thinking, which you can just, like, explain anything by radioactivity. You know, he has six eyes. Wow, it's radioactivity. So he is forced to live on this island by himself with his only friend, a Japanese bomb victim, someone who survives the Hiroshima bomb blast. And they basically starting from year zero in the sense of their cosmological longings are very strong, so they have to make up a whole cosmological system, and that's the hardest work of the book, and also to me the most fun. But I think that that was the literary task I set out for myself, to try to devise a Jungian kind of Mircea Eliade influence cosmological system from these people that only watch TV, you know? So.
Well, and to do it, to fuse it into a kind of bop language, which is, you know...
He's a beatnik monster, there's no doubt about it, you know? He's got this sensibility he has a sensibility of a Sonny Rollins solo or something like that, you know, with a lot of humor and, like, you know, much angst and stuff like that.
Well, I was very happy, you know, the opening sequence in the book after an initial address to fans is the monster and his best friend, the ex-coma kid, coma boy, excuse me, attempting to help the invulnerable monster commit suicide, an impossible act, and they go at it with gusto. And I always think that a book that begins with suicide attempts can only go good places afterward.
It's true, but if they succeed in the first chapter, you don't have much of a book. This book is an attempt to just kind of coalesce. It's sort of my intellectual autobiography, I believe. I often say that. I think it's true. I mean, the more I say it, the more I'm convinced it's true.
During the course of this book, three children were born?
It's true. My wife and I had conceived, and during a period of time which I began writing the book, and when it actually came out, we had three children. We live in the Lower East Side of New York, and being a novelist basically ensured the fact that we would remain there. But, yeah, so in a way, I mean, I think it made the book take longer, but it might have helped in the long run because it gave me a lot of time. It was a lot of downtime, you know.
Well, but I think that in a certain way it must have crept into the content because paternity and biology seem to be...
Yeah, there is that. There is that definitely that line business. You know, you begin to think like, gee, I mean, the point of which I believe... having children is one of the greatest shatterers of narcissism that you can imagine. So therefore, like, and since being a novelist is... in large part about, you know, preserving your narcissism and this frozen moment of, like, you know, like, gee, I'm going to control this world and, like, you know, I'm going to be the great puppet master here and move these things around, you know, and then, like, and then you're, like, dealing with this, like, six-month-old person who just won't do what you want it to do, no matter what you do, you know, no matter all you do, everything you've known, you've picked up in your however many years of living, and it still won't do what you want it to do, you know, it's incredible. So therefore... you begin to realize that the novel is not going to really do what you want it to do either, so you kind of make your peace with it, and you kind of feel like I did the best I could under the circumstances.
Oh, God, this is the first time I've heard it said that raising children is something like controlling the syntax of sentences, getting them to bend the way you want them.
Wow, they're so recalcitrant. It's really incredible. I mean, I don't understand why they just want, you know... supposed to go to sleep at 8:30, wake up at 8:30. That's right. You know, and then you look at the page, and you said, realize, gee, this character is not going anywhere, and it's like this crying child, you know, at 2:30 in the morning.
Oh, and you tell it stories.
Tell it stories, yes. Really, only the only thing they really want to read is the Babysitter Club, but but yeah, I mean, I'm you know, now I have an 8-year one of the oldest child I have is 8 years old, and, you know, I'm always trying to, like, sneak things like, you know, the Aeneid in on her or something like that. But she's too smart for me.
Oh, I meant that you were telling the monster stories in the course of writing the novel.
Oh, the monster, yeah. The monster and I have we go back a long way.
I've been talking to Mark Jacobson, the author of Gojiro, recently published by Atlantic Monthly Press. Thank you for coming down and saying hi to us.
Okay, thank you.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. The engineer is Bob Carlson. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books. As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books. Books, books, books. Too. Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.